The Capital Investment Committee hearing for March 24th is called to order. Quorum is present. Before we get to our agenda for the day, I would like to turn it over to Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today we have some guests in the audience. Mankato East High School is up for Mankato, so I just wanted to say welcome to the committee. This is the Capital Investment Committee, so it's one of the best committees that there are in the House, so you picked a great one to come and see. I know we're going to be meeting at 11:30, but I just wanted to say welcome.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Vice Chair Frederick, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 17th?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Frederick moves the minutes for March 17th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye. Aye, those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, thank you all for being here and for the public for being here today. So with us today, we'll be taking action on two bills and hearing three others on an informational-only basis. The last part of the hearing will be an overview of the future weather trends and infrastructure report commissioned by the 2023 legislature. And we will first start with Chair Cleveland, House File 447. Welcome, Chair. And then I move that House File 4470 to get it before the committee with a recommendation that is referred to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. Chair Cleaborn, please proceed.
Thank you very much. And members, thank you for hearing this important bill. House File 4470 is an appropriation for the Melissa Hortman Memorial. I think it's first important to say this is money which has already been allocated, and this would just be designating the use of the money. The money was allocated in 2023. So it is an $800,000 appropriation to implement the updated Capital Mall design framework under the laws of 2023. It would extend the use of the money through June 30th, 2029. The important part about this memorial is that if we do it now, before the landscaping is done for the new SOB, we will not be duplicating services. We can do it all in one fell swoop. The Capitol Board is aware of this bill and is agreeable to this bill. And members, it would allow that the Capitol Area Architecture and Planning Board select an artist for through a competitive process to design and develop a replica of the immediate family of Melissa Hortman. And the Hortman family would be involved in the process to make sure that the statue designed for this landscaping memorial is in agreement with the family. And any unspent money would go back into the Capitol Mall design framework pool and would be available for additional landscaping elements. And that's the bill.
Thank you, Chair Cleaver. Member, any discussions? Chair Kosnick.
I apologize. I just want to confirm the move or the motion is to move this to State Gov?
That's correct.
That's correct, Mr. Chair Kosnick.
Thank you. I don't have a problem with that.
Members, any additional questions? Well, Chair Cleveland, thank you so very much for bringing this proposal forward to really acknowledge some of the work that Speaker Hortman has done for all of us and to just really put it out there to show future Minnesotans and current Minnesotans when they come to the Capitol to see the impact that she has. And so really appreciate your work on this effort.
Thank
any
you.
Closing comments?
If I may, Chair Lee, to that point, I was asked by one of our colleagues, how many Melissa Hortman things are we going to do, right? And I would just like for this committee to know and for the public to hear that there are so many Minnesotans across this state whose lives have been touched by the work of Melissa Hortman during her 20 years of service. And so these ideas have come not merely from legislators, but from the public. And they are very important to the public who have been touched by her lives. We've heard from people all over this state about the importance of her work. And so this design, I would just like, when CAP Board reached out for ideas of designs, I think it's important to just say how they worded it. This garden would be a place of respite during the long days worked in service for the people of Minnesota. And I think it's important for everyone to know the long hours that Melissa did put in, much like many of you. She was here early and she stayed very late. And to honor her in this way and to allow the people who work in our state to have a beautiful place to sit and have lunch and have respite during their work would be greatly appreciated. And members, I ask for your yes vote.
Thank you, Chair Cleaborn. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 4470 be referred to the State Government Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and House File 4470 is on the way to the State Government Committee. Thank you, Chair Cleaborn.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Chair Tackey's bill, House File 2418. House File 2418, the first engrossment was heard in capital investment on April 30th, 2025. The H-2418 DE-4 amendment was adopted and the bill was laid over as amended. Today, we will take up House File 2418 as amended by the DE-4 for further discussion. And I move the House File 2418, the first engrossment as amended, to move it to before the committee and to recommend that it be referred to the General Register. Chair Tackey, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Lee and Chair Franzen, and I appreciate you hearing this bill. As Chair Lee mentioned, we talked about this last year, and what this bill does is requires that anyone receiving bonding money create a capital maintenance project. And so what we, Chair Lee and Chair Franzen and I have been talking about for a while is that a lot of bonding projects seem to be coming back to Bonding Committee for Capital Investment and continued capital investment for maintenance purposes. And so what we want to do is have this be requiring that folks have a maintenance plan for their projects. So if they're getting state investment in projects that they will continue, that they are required and that they are needed to have a plan for that future investment for projects. And so we worked closely with cities, closely with counties and small cities on this plan, and so it'll essentially be that a box will get checked when they are requesting maintenance, when they're requesting bonding money for projects, and so a box will get checked to make sure that they do have a maintenance plan that they are going to be utilizing for this project.
Thank you, Chair Tackey. And before we turn it over to members' discussion, we do have the A1 amendment to delete the 2026 effective date and change it to 2027. And so with that A1 amendment, any discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none, those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The A1 amendment is adopted. So back to the DE4 amendment as amended. And with that, first question is Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair Tackey. I do have a couple questions. Have we gotten any local impact notes on this? Because this will add to the cost of pre-planning and planning.
Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, no, we have not gotten that. But I think that this is something that already is already in place for most cities as to what they are doing when they are building a project, when they're doing some sort of project in a community. They better have a maintenance plan that is on there. So it is something that absolutely should be happening so that we are making sure that when an HVAC goes out in a building that there is a plan for replacing that and how that happens into the future.
Representative Sexton.
I've got several more additional questions. I don't disagree with you, but I would like an idea of what the cost would be. Since we do have quite a few. And I'm glad you mentioned building, because as I read the bill, it seems like we're focused maybe in the author's mind of a fire station or something like that. But we have a lot of projects that don't actually involve a structure. So what I don't see in here is anything to talk about exceptions so that we clarify the boundaries which require the CIP versus do not. So that's an observation. You can comment if you like.
Chair Tackey.
Thank you. The League of Minnesota Cities is here, and I think that they would be able to add some more context to this that would be outside of what I would add. So if, Mr. Chair, that would be okay.
Okay. We see Craig Johnson with the League. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed to the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, very much appreciate that this bill is before the committee. As the chair well knows, we've worked on this for many years to figure out ways to make sure that the right kind of planning has occurred at the local level. And to the specific theme of questions asked about the cost and the planning involved in this, if a project from a city goes through any of the normal state pots of money where it's a competitive grant program, all of this would have to already be done. This would only apply to projects that are applying to the governor's capital budget so that they would show up as a potential earmark in a future capital budget bill. And it's just basically asking that the same level of planning has to have existed and that the community verify that by checking a box when they apply for that, the same way that they have to do it for other financial assurances as part of their project, just to make sure that they've done the same planning that other facilities would have to do to get into the other pots of money.
Representative Sexton.
Well, with someone who's got considerable construction experience and used to be on the Planning Commission, I'm surprised I haven't heard about this initiative. So one thing I would like to see is at least a five-year sunset incorporated into the bill so we can collect some data and see if this is even useful and get some feedbacks to maybe some tweaks. So I'm going to be a no as in not yet, and I'm going to request a roll call.
A roll call being requested will be a roll call at the end of the discussion. Any additional? Chair Franzen. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And Co-Chair Franzen, I'm surprised.
But I was left speechless.
Well, I'm not. Thank you for bringing this bill. I think this makes a lot of sense. And traveling the state, you know, touring for this committee, you see so many projects, so many done projects that hadn't been taken care of and planned for. So I appreciate your efforts on this. Thank you.
Dumb projects? Did you say dumb or done?
No, done.
Okay. Representative Scrava.
Not dumb.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Tapke, Chair Tapke. Several questions. So this is just pertaining to the governor's earmarks. It doesn't have anything to do with the other capital investment bond because we're already, quote, doing it. This bill is just for the governor's earmarks. Is that correct?
Chair Tapke.
Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, and Representative Scrava, correct.
Okay.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you. So the same rules apply, you know, because it got my brain going in a million different directions. So you have the commissioner can stop the project if they don't have that information there. It says the commissioner may require a grantee to provide additional documentation or information about capital project plan to verify a certification made under this subdivision. So if they don't do it, then he can say, they can say, the commissioner can say, nope, I need that.
Representative Scrava, are you referring to the DE4 amendment or the bill as introduced? Because we did adopt the DE4 amendment. Okay, the DE4 amendment is confined to just providing that information when they submit their project to MMB.
You are correct. That this is not.
That's right.
This is the new bill. Yeah. Okay. And then.
Representative Scrava.
Thank you, Chair. Lee, and that's final. That's good. Thank you.
Chair Tacky.
Chair Lee and Chair Franz and Representative Scrava, I just want to make sure that we're very clear on this, is that the goal on this is to leave the power and the decision-making authority with the legislature. So this is information to be given to the legislature. If there's a maintenance plan that's terrible or if there's no maintenance plan or something like that, you still have the ability to do this. It's just required that a city puts that forward and that box is checked that they're working on that, not necessarily just a city, but that is happening and that information is available and they've thought through those things as to how to make sure that this project stays available and viable into the future. And so it leaves all of the decision making still with the legislature as to how that moves forward.
Representative Scrava.
Okay, and just the way you're describing it, it makes it sound like you're going back into our normal bonding requests that this bill reaches into those and make sure that they have a plan. But don't they already before they come here?
Representative Hafke.
That's the problem, is that no, they don't already. They don't all already have plans. So this is making sure that everybody has a maintenance plan for projects as they come forward.
Representative Grava.
Thank you, Chair. So it's not just for the governor, it's for everybody's bill.
Chair Tacky.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Sorry. The way we discussed this before was that when a water facility or a sewage facility or whatever that may be that has big other grants attached to it and those kinds of things, those already have a maintenance plan as to how that this moves forward on this. So if there's a city project or something like that that's in it gets signed by the governor that does not have a maintenance project, this is something that requires into the future that they have a maintenance project, maintenance plan in place for these things. So we're making sure that we're maintaining these facilities as they're getting built.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tapke. Next up, Chair Franzen again.
Let's go again. I seem to find my words now. Members, we are on the DE4. Okay, so last year we vetted the original bill. Representative Tapke and I discussed it at length. He introduced the DE4. We did adopt that last year as well. Okay, it was laid over. We never did anything with it. He's back again. Last year we laid it over without any consternation, no opposition, absolutely nothing. It was completely watered down. He worked with the League of Minnesota Cities. We made sure everything. I talked to Craig to make sure he was okay. The cities were okay. The bill, the amendment as drafted, I am okay with. I know that there is some consternation on the word sustainability. Representative Tapke, could you explain, because the BE3 requirements that raise the cost of items, okay? So perhaps we can change some minds if we can work on that word a little bit.
Okay.
Tapke.
I'm happy to continue to work on the language as is necessary. If there are issues with that, we can absolutely work on it and get it so that it makes sense for everyone. This is something that we want to make sure that we are using state dollars as wisely as possible and making sure that we are doing the right things moving forward. So very happy to discuss and continue to work on it if this is able to move forward.
Chair Franzen.
Thank you. This is not like it's your reelection bill.
Correct.
Right? Okay. Oh, that's true. Maybe. I won by one vote. I guess I can, you know, say that too. Okay, so that's all I had. Thank you.
So you know, other questions, Chair Tacky and Chair Franzen, thank you both for working on this. And members, I think, you know, as a previous author, just wanted to chime in on this bill that, you know, we're not doing anything new. The only thing that's new is, you know, when they're submitting a request, should this be in law, they just check the box to see if they have a plan or not. Just and it is really up to the legislature. We want to follow up with them to see, hey, you know, can you talk a little bit more about your plan or whatnot? But at the end of the day, this is just information gathering for us. This doesn't preclude them or, you know, negate their bills or whatnot. You know, we still go through the normal bonding process as we do. Representative Sexton.
I'll withdraw my roll call request.
Representative Sexton, withdraw the roll call request. Members, any additional questions? Hearing none, I renew my motion that House File 2418, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
Aye.
The motion prevails and House File 2418, as amended, is referred to the General Register.
Thank you very much, Chair Tacky. Appreciate it.
Now, next on the agenda, all of these bills will be heard on an informational basis only with 5 minutes allocated for every bill. First up is House File 34717, Representative Purcell. And then after that will be the two bills from Chair Freiberg. Welcome, Representative Purcell. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chairs Lee and Franzen, for having me. I was expecting the city administrator from the city of Lonsdale to join me, who has a lot more details about the 2023 study that is the basis for, come on up, for this proposal. So House File 3417 that you're hearing on just a informational basis. The city of Lonsdale has never asked for capital investment funds before, and the city of Lonsdale is requesting $4.8 million for a water tower. There's a lot of really great visuals in your packet, as well as a breakdown of what that funding would be used for, but I will turn it over in our precious 5 minutes to my testifier.
Welcome, please identify yourself and proceed.
All right, good morning, chairs, members of the committee. I'm Joel Erickson, the city administrator. Along with me is Joe Dornfeld, our public works director. As Representative Purcell said, we're requesting funding for the design, construction, and construction engineering-related services for a water tower and water main loop. How did we get here? Back in 2023, the city completed a comprehensive water study, which identified our needs for the next 15 years. Based off the modeling conducted as part of the study, it was recommended that we add a second water tower and water main loop. The request would address system redundancy. If there's a break, and one of the maps shows that there's a line and basically everything to the bottom right of that, 20% or 300 households would be without water if we have a water main break on Industrial Drive Southeast. Fortunately, we haven't been in that situation, but we've been close 2 times in the last 3 years. It'll help with fire protection, pressure stabilization, and then address peak demand needs. As a public purpose, providing potable water to our residents and businesses is a core service that we provide. Maintaining and improving components of our water system is critical in the city successfully meeting those needs. As far as the project timeline, we'd be looking at design fall of 27, agency approvals winter of 27, spring of 28. Looking at bidding the project, March of 28, award in April, with construction beginning May of 2028, and construction being completed in November. We'll own and operate the water system within the guidelines of the Minnesota Department of Health. To get to this point, we've purchased the necessary land for the water tower and installed the 12-inch water main to connect it to our water system. Our council has always been forward-thinking, reconstructing old sections of town, adding other water main loops where needed to increase redundancy and fire protection. We've also constructed a water treatment plant to remove radium and other contaminants from our water. The study identified $12 million worth of needs over the next 15 years, and this water tower and water main loop was identified as a main priority. The funding request would assist the city offset anticipated system costs over the next several years and reduce the burden on our households. Recently, we've experienced a dramatic increase in interest in both residential and business development. A number of acres in our business park has been sold. We received an offer the other day for the remaining 12 acres. So this is really important for water redundancy and fire protection to diversify, which essentially mainly a residential tax base. Some of the projects that we've got working on, preliminary plat for Hunter Lot subdivision will be coming next week. We've approved and anticipate construction beginning on a 58-unit apartment complex in July. And then, as I said, meeting with builders, developers, and business owners on occupying the remaining 12 acres of our business park. This will address short-term needs and allow the city to address long-term needs, such as biosolids at our wastewater treatment plant. Again, thank you for the opportunity, for your time and consideration. And if there's any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Director, do you have a PFA number? Have you applied for any public finance or anything like that?
At this point, we have not. We just got the study back, and with the timing of the funding request, wanted to get this in, so we met the timeline.
All right.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. The other question I had, are your water rates commensurate? Are they normal? Are they high? Are they low? Where are they compared to your other communities around you?
City Administrator.
Chair, Representative Starba, our rates are comparable with surrounding communities.
Okay. All right.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. I'm good. Thank you.
So I just have a question. So the request, is this for the full amount of the project? Are you guys able to contribute half to the project?
Chair, the request is for the full amount. We've, as I previously stated, probably $350,000 into water main extension and land purchase.
Thank you.
And
Chair Lee. Closing comments, Representative Purcell.
Thank you. Because of the city's looking at the overall, you know, over $12 million in infrastructure needs. So this is just sort of this one part of the project.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
All right, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Chair Freiberg. The first bill is House File 3365. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing House File 3365 on an informational basis. This bill would provide $20 million for a public works facility in the city of Robbinsdale. The current public works building is vintage 1950s. There's failing mechanicals. There's a leaking roof. All the repairs that are being done on it are temporary and no longer good use of tax dollars. Robbinsdale has outgrown the current building. Modern-day plows, fire trucks, and vehicles like that don't fit in the mechanics bays to get to do the work on them, and they're having to store vehicles outside, which leads to quicker failures. The city has taken on initial planning and design costs. More than $1 million have been dedicated, and with those funds and the project being in the city's 10-year plan, the city has long shown a commitment to this project. Robbinsdale faces a 100-year-old underground infrastructure due to the age of the city. This means that taxes and utility funds are dedicated to replacements before catastrophic failure. The city has not received any state bonding funds in recent history, so this is a newer type of request for the city. I appreciate the committee's consideration, and with me is City Manager Tim Sandvik.
Welcome, City Manager. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Committee members, my name is Tim Sandvik with the City of Robbinsdale. I serve as the City Manager.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. As Representative Freiberg shared, the City of Robbinsdale is in a unique set of circumstances in that a first-rank, some say original, suburb of Minneapolis, our aged infrastructure is such that our utility fees and general tax levy go towards the replacement of those pieces. Our neighbors to the west and second and third ring suburbs will start to face those challenges as we go forward. But what that presents to us, these larger type of investments into capital, what we have dedicated and have planned for, they make their tougher for us to accomplish. As also noted, it's not something that we've put forward through this process, through state bonding in recent history for other types of facilities. So we're here with this ask today. The in total ask that the city is making is for half, and the city is dedicated to finding and sourcing other funds to make up for that. With that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Members, any discussions? Seeing none, closing comments, Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, committee members and co-chairs. This is an important investment in an inner ring suburb that I represent, and I really appreciate your consideration for it.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Next up, we have House File 3463. Chair Freiberg, please proceed.
Yep. Thank you once again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So this bill would provide $15 million to the city of Crystal to replace a water main under Busy County Road that provides water from the city of Minneapolis to the cities of Crystal, Golden Valley, and New Hope. This segment of pipe is more than 60 years old and has experienced two catastrophic breaks in recent years, resulting in significant damages and replacement costs for the city and its residents. Over 70,000 residents and businesses rely on this water source. Under the proposal, Hennepin County would provide $8 million, and the local match is $3.2 million. And with me is Jesse Struve from the City of Crystal.
Welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jesse Struve. I'm the Director of Public Works and City Engineer for the City of Crystal. This project's one of the kind of rare cooperative projects between the Hennepin County, cities of Golden Valley, Crystal, and New Hope. This water main, Hennepin County came to us last year with a major rehabilitation project on the Douglas Drive, which facilitated us to, this is our one opportunity to replace this water main, about 3 miles of water main, 30-inch pipe that on an annual basis transmits about over 3 billion gallons of water to the three communities. It impacts 70,000 residents, numerous businesses through our area, and it's had two catastrophic failures in the recent history. So it's our one opportunity to come to it. It was a project that came to us last minute, and We don't have the funds offhand to move forward with this $26 million project. So we're requesting $15 million with, again, $3 million in local costs, and an additional $8 million from Hennepin County. With that, I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Members, any questions? Representative Scraba.
Thank you. So the $15 million is just for the water main?
Correct. The overall project costs are $26 million. The total water main replacement cost is $18 to $20 million of that, with the remaining $6 to $8 million for pavement rehabilitation costs.
Representative Scraba.
Very good. Thank you. I'm just mind numb there. Thank you.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Let me applaud your commitment from Hennepin County. I tried to get money from Hennepin County to redo County Road 47, now Chancata, and I got precious little, so my hat's off to you. I don't know how you guys did it, but congrats. Maybe it was Representative Freiberg. Yeah.
Chair, committee members, Hennepin County led this project originally, so they came to us saying we're going to be doing this project. They've been very cooperative in delaying their project. It was supposed to be a 2026 project. They've delayed it to 2028, 2029, depending on our funding requests. So it's been a good working relationship between multiple regional agencies, and it's very important, again, for the three communities, because if we come back for this project in 5-10 years, we're going to be disturbing newly created pavement and added $8 to $10 million in pavement costs.
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I believe there's also a plan by the Three Rivers Park District to potentially put in a trail along this corridor, so it would have additional benefits that could be coordinated with the water main replacement.
Along a portion of the corridor, correct, yes. They'd be looking at adding a trail that they may jump in with our project if we're going this full route.
Seeing no other questions, quick closing comments, Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is an important project along a busy street that provides a resource to not just one city, but multiple cities that are part of the Joint Water Commission, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg, for joining us today. Next up, members, we have an overview of the future weather trends and infrastructure report. I want to welcome Dr. Graves, Dr. Hellman, and Dr. Roop to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, members of the committee.
We have a presentation we need to hook.
Oh, we have a presentation.
Jenny,
to drive.
You should be able to pull it up on that, Richard. Oh.
We'll start our presentation by seeing how technologically savvy Professor Graves is. Yes. Well, while he does that, I will go ahead and introduce us. My name is Jessica Hellman. I'm joined by my colleagues, Dr. Richard Graves and Dr. Heidi Roop. We are all from the University of Minnesota. And we are grateful for the opportunity to be here with you today. We are here this morning to report on some work that you commissioned, examining how Minnesota can better prepare its infrastructure for a changing climate. And we represent the team that conducted the research in this report. As you know, the legislature asked the university to undertake this research to provide evidence-based information that can help you make fiscally responsible, forward-looking decisions about the state's infrastructure. So I will first briefly describe what it is that you asked us to do, and then we'll walk through what we found and how it can be useful to this committee's work. All right, great.
Just be small.
Maybe.
Maybe.
You could just hold your laptop up. It should work.
You have the HDMI plugged in? No, I do.
There you go. There's your whole screen. Okay, so Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, on our second slide, next slide.
Thank you.
We have the language of the legislative charge. So in essence, you asked us to examine how future climate conditions can be integrated into the design and evaluation of Minnesota's infrastructure, and how the state can do that in a way that is systematic, transparent, and fair to Minnesota's communities and taxpayers. So our job in this report was to do three things. First, we summarize what we know about Minnesota's climate and how it's changing and what that means for critical infrastructure. Second, develop a framework that helps you and your partners and collaborators think about infrastructure as part of an interconnected system of social, ecological, and technical components. And third, to show you how that framework could guide investment decisions so that when you spend dollars on infrastructure, you're preparing both for today's conditions and considering tomorrow's risks. So in the next part of the presentation, well, Richard and Heidi are both gonna illustrate this for real projects across the state. I will have something to say about the framework that we've adapted, and we'll make our way through a presentation of what we conducted and what we found.
Great, thank you. So it's important to understand when we're thinking about future infrastructure investments in response to future weather, so it's important to understand it in the context of in the Midwest, significant investments are required to modernize our infrastructure. So in a 2021 study, the American Society of Civil Engineers estimated about $7,547 per capita for everyone in the Midwest is needed just for modernizing infrastructure systems. So if you translate that to Minnesota, that number is about $50 billion needed to modernize our systems. And as we're modernizing those systems and making those investments, considering future weather is an important consideration to make sure we're building and preparing for future design conditions that these roads, bridges, dams will be operating within. The slide here shows the Rapidan Dam that in 2023 failed. And it's a good example of there was a study in 2021 after the dam had been exposed to high waters and flooding in 2019, 2020, that to upgrade the dam would have cost $15 million to be able to deal with those conditions. And as I said, in 2023, the dam failed. It's estimated that that is going to cost about $88 billion to remove the dam, replace the bridge that was demolished, I think it's the County Highway 9 bridge. The two XL substations were damaged, and the house and shed that were also damaged. So it's a good example of when we're thinking about infrastructure systems, you have to think about them integrated across sectors, from dams to roads to bridges to the built environment. You know, it's we often think of these things in silos, but they're integrated across systems. And as Jessica mentioned, it's also important to think of them integrated across ecosystems, benefits to society, and what's the role of the technology or infrastructure as it's doing those things. We're using this the Rapidan Dam as an example, but we also could have used projects from all across the state, like the 90% of the buildings at Bemidji State that were damaged from straight line winds that all need window upgrades, siding replacement, and those kinds of things. It's a challenge that we're facing across different infrastructure systems all across the state. So the team from the University of Minnesota, we worked across all of our different institutes and centers. We also we had about 12 focus groups with a range of people from members of different state departments, local government units, federal government units. We also met with university researchers, not just at the University of Minnesota, but other institutions that are studying these issues.
In addition, we met with a number of trade associations and other associations like the League of Minnesota Cities, AIA Minnesota, and a couple of the engineering trade associations to get their input on how are they using future weather data, how are they seeing these impacts on the things they design, and we brought that into the report that you can see structured here, which gives sort of background on the issues, an overview of future climate data and how it was used in our process and meeting with different stakeholders to frame the issues across the five infrastructure systems you asked us to focus on: water, agriculture, forestry, built environment, and natural habitat. It's important to note, and we'll get into this more as we outline the report, you know, Chapter 3 in particular, it's a complex issue across complex systems. And so kind of a key part of the report is the third chapter where we outline a framework to try to organize all of this complexity and to be able to analyze and make policy recommendations and do scenario planning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I've been tasked with outlining a bit of our current weather and climate context. So I serve as the state's extension specialist for climate and risk management. And this slide illustrates what we're observing. So Minnesota is already experiencing change in our climate context. Whether we look at patterns in our seasonal rainfall, temperature, snowfall, pest and disease pressure, flooding, or air quality, it's evident in the data that we see the overall pattern of risk our state is facing, bringing more impacts to critical infrastructure, industry, communities, and the budgets of state and local governments, households, and businesses. Observations of changing temperature and rainfall, these are observations that are collected by Minnesotans in your districts, show Minnesota is warmer and wetter than in the past. Our average annual air temperature has increased by over 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1895, and our average annual precipitation has increased by over 3 inches per year. We are moving more quickly and more frequently between extreme wet and extreme dry conditions, posing substantial risk management challenges. I see some nodding, right? This is an impossible bind, near impossible bind. These physical changes that we've already observed are clearly stressing aging and vulnerable infrastructure. This includes dams, roads, culverts, bridges, stormwater, and drinking water systems. I'll use those as a brief example. As we look across the state, from the cities of Alden, Belgrade, Comfrey, Eagle Lake, Hayfield, Le Sueur, La Crescent, and Lake Wilson, to Bellingham, Graceville, Coon Rapids, Virginia, Aurora, Babbitt, and between and around, these are communities that are already seeking and securing state funding for climate resiliency grants to plan for and improve the resiliency of their stormwater and drinking water systems. These are funds being sought by the cities themselves, highway departments, and watershed districts. This means that we're already facing and confronting these costs and challenges today, where they intersect with our aging and vulnerable infrastructure. But what we do know very clearly is that what we're experiencing today is really just the beginning. When we look to the future, as we have in this study, we understand that we need very clearly to integrate data and tools, on-the-ground lived experiences and perspectives, and information and frameworks to think about how we plan for, anticipate, and invest wisely in the future ahead. Next slide, please. This report offers such a framework and utilizes Minnesota-specific climate risk data that my team has produced alongside, as Richard mentioned, the experiences and perspectives and realities of hundreds of professionals and city members that are navigating these changes in their unique and often challenging contexts. As a way of orientation to these maps, sorry, this is very classic scientist here. I gave you 8 maps. We're looking here at a series of projections of seasonal temperature change projected to occur by the end of the century. Showing you all these graphs is by design, because in the report, we utilize a range of possible outcomes or scenarios to evaluate the physical risks that may stress our infrastructure, society, and ecosystems. This report uses well-established global development scenarios that explore how different societal choices like demographics, economic growth, technological innovation and implementation, and policy all impact global greenhouse gas emissions. These scenarios are then used in our research in a highly localized manner to understand how this would translate into physical risks and changes in Minnesota's unique climate. Here we're showing that increased greenhouse gas emissions increase the seasonal temperature across the state. So here we're looking at all of the seasons. We're looking at two different scenarios, one that is intermediate emissions, which is showing us a world following historical trends. And the bottom graph, the darker red colors, are showing us a scenario with expanded fossil fuel development globally. Darker colors mean greater temperature change relative to the period of 1995 to 2014. So again, we're referencing things that we've all experienced in this room to what we think the future change will be. So we look again at a range of scenarios. It's very evident here that the higher emissions, again, these are global, translate into higher projected temperature changes locally. Next slide, please. Here we see the same structure, the same maps, but I'm showing you seasonal change and precipitation. This is both rainfall and, as in the case of the winter, snow. We see with the blue colors representing an increase and red colors representing a seasonal decrease in precipitation, again, relative to the same time period of 1995 to 2014.
Mr. Chair, if I could just point of order a question real quick.
Chair Kosnick.
What was the year's span that these changes are? I think it's different from what you said from what's in the packet.
Dr. Root.
We are looking here at projected seasonal change by 2080 to 2099, so the end of the century. We call this in the climate projections world the end of the century, so by 2100. We're looking at, across a range of scenarios, two different emission scenarios. One is very high. Those are the bottom graphs. The upper graph is intermediate emissions. That reflects the pathway that we're currently, that's historical trends, continue into the future. So the report utilizes both of these, and we're showing temperature by the end of the century. And in this slide that's shown here, this is precipitation by season, projected to change. In this graph, it's showing you change in the number of inches relative to historical.
Chair Kosnick.
Just to clarify, I think one of the slides said 1895, and I think your comments, or maybe I misheard you, was 1995.
Sorry, Chair Lee, Chair Franson. So the first slide, those are observed changes. These are changes that we have measured. These are often collected and delivered to the State Climatology Office and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration by way of weather observers on the landscape. Our recording period in the state of Minnesota goes back to the year 1895. So our observations of change are referenced against that year when records were deemed robust. There are scattered places where those records are longer. But the State Climatology Office, housed at the Department of Natural Resources, historically uses and references our full observational record as 1895 to present. And so those observed changes, in this case, are representing that period. In the subsequent slides, we're now looking forward using different tools. So it's a distinction. But thank you for seeking clarification.
Chair Kosnick.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It makes sense that it's a much wider time frame than what I thought I heard.
Yes, so 1895 to 2024 in this case is the historical record we're referencing.
Chair Franson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I will be dead by 2080. Hopefully I'm in heaven. That's the plan. But let's just say that these trends don't come true, much like other trends that have not come true, like ice-free Arctic summers never came true. The 1970s coming ice age never came true. Rapid sea level rise never came true. Volcanic winter miscalculation never came true. Extreme weather overestimates. So I'm just wondering, like, we paid for this report. I'm just wondering, when it doesn't happen, then what? We'll all be dead, so we'll never know if your report came true or not, but could you elaborate? Like, there's been trends that have been reported to be happening and never transpired, and people get all worked up. We spend a lot of money to prevent such trends and for nothing.
Dr. Root.
Yes, Chair Lee, Chair Franson, thank you for those questions. Be happy to elaborate more on each of those individual points. They're often utilizing different reference periods. But what I can say from the evidence base and from what's been published, that in many cases, what's been documented exceeds what we are actually planning for. And while I don't know, I may be alive in 2100, many of the investments that are being made by this committee have useful lifespans that reach into that time period. 70 years, 100 years, some of our aging infrastructure is quite old. So for the earlier century, what I'm showing here, we've looked at end of century. The report also references mid-century, which is 16 to 33 years from today. And so we look at that bound of possibilities across the same ranges. And again, I'd be very happy to talk to you about each of those individual points. But generally, we're seeing that climate models, such as those that are being shown here, are underestimates and are conservative in relation to the impacts that we are experiencing on the landscape. And again, very happy to have more conversation, but want to also leave time for my colleagues to speak to the details of the report.
Dr. Graves.
Chair Lee, Chair Franson, you know, I think one thing to keep in mind that we heard over and over again from the different trade associations representing architects, engineers, contractors, is that, you know, even though there are different scenarios in the future projections, the historic data they're using now to design many of these systems, they're already seeing that historic data being inadequate to predict the conditions, the things they're designing or operating within right now, let alone 2099. So I think that is a important takeaway from the report, that you know, there's different scenarios in the kind of future weather data, but the fact that we're using historic data is inadequate to our design process. So,
Chair Friends, any follow up?
No, but I have a lot of comments in my head.
At the end of the presentation, please proceed with the presentation.
Great, Chair Lee Transen. We now will turn with that background of individual pieces of infrastructure, how they are in need of modernizing, but also facing changing conditions. And Dr. Rip really highlighted for us the range of possibilities and how we think about making decisions in the face of those range of possibilities and scenarios. One of the clearest lessons that comes from our work in thinking about future infrastructure planning and notions of resilience and in interactions with stakeholders that we spoke with is how critical it is that the different systems that you are operating with in infrastructure do not operate. In fact, they also do not fail in isolation. And this ends up being critical to the framework that we recommend or offer in our report. These systems and their failure under even current conditions sit at the intersection of what we call sets. So social systems, that's S, ecological systems, E, and technical systems, T, sets. When we focus on just one of these, a technical solution, an ecological consequence, a social implication, we often have the possibility of fixing one issue and unintentionally creating an issue somewhere else. We call this notion maladaptation. It's where a solution in one place to a changing set of conditions increases a risk or a cost in another part of the system. The framework illustrated on this slide is our way of helping you avoid that maladaptation. In fact, also thinking about how you can best take advantage of opportunities in changing conditions. So when we formally link this consideration of social, ecological, and technical systems, we are using a sets approach. Now, this idea of sets we did not invent this from scratch. We did draw upon existing work that's in the scientific literature, and we adapted it specific for Minnesota and the kinds of decisions that this committee faces. In practical terms, a framework like this gives you a structured way of asking questions like, how does this investment affect communities and budgets? How does it interact with land and water and ecosystems? How does it change the performance and reliability of the infrastructure itself under future climate conditions? So using a sets lens helps align goals, track risks and opportunities across systems, and ultimately make sure that when you solve one problem, for changing conditions, you're not quietly creating two or more problems somewhere else. In fact, this line of thinking, this framework, could allow for a solution in one domain to actually yield benefits in another domain.
Yeah, so why is this important? You know, as we met with different stakeholder groups across different infrastructure systems, they're really all working in silos. They're tracking goals for roads that might be, you know, different than goals for buildings, different from the energy sector. They're also may or may not be tracking social benefits and ecological impacts in a similar way. And so this framework created a way to have goals in common across systems is really, you know, what we outline in the report. It's a way to communicate across infrastructure systems that really work in silos right now. So it would be a way to, to look at societal benefits we're trying to create, track ecological impacts, and then the technology parts, often the infrastructure. Then you can have coordinated, infrastructure support. For example, a watershed district might be looking at solving some of their flooding problems, and they could look across upgrades to the stormwater system, upgrades to the building sites, preserving forest land, looking at storage systems on agriculture land to come up with a combined infrastructure solution to that need is the way this could work. In addition, we think it's important to think of that sets layer of a kind of communication language in the context of, as you're doing infrastructure planning, you're also thinking about goals and risks and opportunities and how do those intersect to develop plans for the future. When we met with stakeholders, many, many groups are just collecting lists of risks, and they're not sort of going through those risks and thinking about what's our overarching goal here that we're trying to solve as we make infrastructure decisions. And this framework could help do some of that. We also created, I won't go into it for the sake of time, but we created a process that could be used by a state agency or the legislature to look at going through resilient infrastructure planning and using some of this data. And then specifically in the report, one of the things you asked us to look at was what's the impact on the built environment, specifically what about energy usage. So in the report, we ran a model of different building types. I'm showing single family homes on this slide. And we ran energy models of those single-family homes across Minnesota using historic data and showed their energy usage, which is on the left-hand side. And then we ran it also across the different future weather scenarios Heidi outlined. What we see in general is energy usage actually comes down because the period of intense cold in the winter starts to reduce. And so that reduces overall energy usage. But it changes the energy mix because we use less natural gas and heating fuels, but the cooling, summers are hotter, so the cooling energy goes up. So less natural gas, more electric usage. Again, this is data and a way of analysis that the PUC could be using to say, are we doing good utility planning to have different fuel mixes, et cetera. In addition, one thing that we also looked at with this data across the built environment is we looked at unmet heating and cooling hours. And what we see in the same scenario, again, single family home, historic data, and the different projections, one thing that's concerning is that in the summertime, we start to have increasingly higher and higher amounts of time for unmet cooling hours, which gives us some things to think about when we think about weatherization, where often we're doing weatherization just insulating building envelopes, and we really should be thinking about weatherization that's doing that plus adding cooling systems to building to decrease those unsafe times in buildings. So with that, I'll just give an overview of the recommendations that we had in the report, and then we can close and take questions. So we had a range of recommendations in different areas. The first set was looking at future weather scenarios, and we recommended that the legislature should look to provide funding to do additional research on the use of future weather and infrastructure planning by local governments and the state government. What's the intersection between local governments using some of this data and state government? We met with the League of Minnesota Cities about some of this work and discussed a number of use cases they would have for using some of this scenario planning and data. Hmm. For the governance and resilient infrastructure policy, we recommended that the legislature should consider reviewing bond-funded projects for their impacts and potential benefits on infrastructure with a consideration of future weather trends and integration across different units of government. And the Department of Administration could work with Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to develop goals on resilient infrastructure with support from us if needed. For resilient infrastructure and planning, we recommend the legislature work with the Department of Administration on integrating resilience into the bonding process and look at funding additional research on implementing some kind of resilient infrastructure planning, scenario planning to make decisions again. In concert with local units of government to make integrated decisions. For the built environment, the legislature should fund and respond to risk assessments, including extreme heat resistance for existing buildings and infrastructure and upgrade as needed. In addition, there are opportunities at looking at building sites for flood mitigation that can assist with some of the challenges in watersheds around the state. And then in addition to that, we had a goal that the Department of Administration could work with the University of Minnesota to continue to integrate resilience into the B3 standards and look for guidelines that could apply to all state-owned facilities. And then two more sets. In natural systems and habitat, we looked at funding coordinated programs to look at resilience across natural systems. The legislature could also, and then the legislature could fund development of approach to measure resilience to future weather scenarios that would develop standardized resilience indicators. And again, the Department of Administration could work with other agencies to develop those standards and guidelines. And then finally, this report was complex set of research across complex systems. So, there's definitely additional work to be done, not just research, but also coordinating with the private sector, local units of government, and others to think about how we could create, coordinated work going forward, not only for research, but also doing some of the scenario planning and tracking actions and impacts to infrastructure.
Great, and not to further complicate matters, but Chair Lee did request a brief overview to situate some of this in the fiscal impacts. You all have been delivered by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency a new legislative report on the costs of adaptation in the state of Minnesota. I won't go into length on this multi-hundred page report, but I will just briefly highlight that while you all think critically about ensuring a robust, prepared, and resilient Minnesota, there is more responsibility coming to states to think about resilience and what that means and making those strategic investments. And there's a remaining question around how much will that cost and is there a rate of return? So just briefly, without going into the top lines of the full report, which I'm happy to describe in more detail in a one-on-one meeting or subsequent conversations, but the report shows that when we think about our transportation and electric infrastructure in the state of Minnesota, that incremental investments on the order of $0.8 billion annually for roads, rail, culverts, and electric infrastructure in the next 16 to 33 years, so this is around mid-century, could prevent over $4.3 billion annually in repair and delay costs projected in the absence of preparedness. And this is under a medium scenario, and it's sort of middle. We use different scenarios, of course, go figure, in this report. But it's showing very clearly that dollars invested today with resilience in mind are often avoiding damages that are borne out by government, they're borne out by industry, and they're borne out by individual Minnesotans. So we also understand that increasingly factoring in these types of impacts and making one-time investments strategically with our future climate in mind result in fiscal benefits to the state and, of course, human health and well-being. So again, without going into more detail, which I'm happy to do at a later date, I'll pass it to Jessica to close us out.
Well, you'll all be happy to see this, our last slide. We'd like to close with three simple takeaways. First, that Minnesota is changing. The climate and environmental conditions that our infrastructure was built for are not the conditions that it is facing now and will face in the coming decades. That means that the state's existing backlog of modernization sits alongside a growing need to adapt that infrastructure to future extremes. Second, our report offers a systems-based framework that you might use to navigate this reality. It does not tell you what to decide, but it gives you a transparent Minnesota-specific way to stress test investments against a range of futures and to think about these trade-offs in these different domains that have historically been thought of in silos, the ecological, the social, and the technical. That can be a pathway to enable cost savings, to smart investment, and to policy innovation. And thirdly, we have researched and just generated for you a framework. My colleagues have both referenced that there is much more work to do, and that work is shared. It involves the legislature, state agencies, local governments, private industry, communities across the state. The university's role, as you asked us to do in this case, can be to provide research, analysis, and technical assistance that might support those decisions. But we think that the framework in this report can be a useful tool for that ongoing conversation between those many different kinds of stakeholders. And we are also ready to stand by and help when it might be appropriate. So with that, chairs and members, we'd be happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, three, for the presentation and the information that you provided. First up, Representative Paredes Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. You know, just highlighting the effects of climate change is important in the infrastructure. I did a lot of hurricane relief in Puerto Rico post-Maria, and folks may think, yeah, hurricanes happen there, but the effects of climate change cause so much rainfall post, and the biggest biggest cost was the infrastructure, the bridges, the roads. And then I connect that to here, being in Minnesota and recognizing, I mean, we had a blizzard just last Sunday and then or Saturday night, and then it was the following week, 75 degrees, right? And you look at the effects and studying and speaking with local partners in government on what transportation looks like. Well, we've got to fix the roads first, right? Because we've got sinkholes that are really affected by these freezing temps and going into high temperatures. So, you know, highlighting the importance of what does the built environment look like and what that even looks like in our most urban settings, so to say, that kind of get left out of the boat here. And so I just want to appreciate you highlighting the effects of, you know, what a future looks like. We may not be able to see everything, but we can advocate to be proactive instead of reactive, because the reactiveness is very traumatic. And we want to be able to have good roads in Minnesota, and it takes a lot of consciousness of the studies that you've provided. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Next up, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Franzen, and members also for taking the time to listen to this. I appreciate you presenting all this information about what we're looking at as the results of events that we have all lived through and experienced. We've all lived through the images of the house falling into the river and the Rapidam Dam. We've all seen the impact of the hurricane force winds in Bemidji.
I was just saying to Representative Myers, they didn't clear that dam, and it made the water flow different. They let it get built up.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you. I'm easily distracted, apparently, by side conversations. But what I've been thinking about in reading this report and reflecting on it is that over the course of 6 years on this committee, I've been thinking a lot about how we make funding decisions and how we set our priorities for the state. I mean, that's really the role of our committee, is to say we've got this pool, maybe it's $700 million, maybe it's $1.2 billion, and we're using that in a way that's prioritized out across the state. So how do we do that? What are the principles we use? And it strikes me that it's really hard to get there without shared goals, even if they're very high level. And so I would argue that we need to find a shared outcome. I know that there are differences. There are words that I won't use in my comments because I know that they bring up images that are not necessarily intended. But I think if you look at the very bottom, we all want to be able to help our communities, help our state now and into the future. I think you probably care, Chair Franzen, that future generations have a place that's safe to live. And yeah, you know, I think you probably do. And I'm going to bet that all of us care that our communities can continue to be safe. That's a pretty easy statement to make. I think maybe we can agree that we have seen more heavy rainstorms and more days without rain. I mean, that's just data, if you looked at it. No projections, just looking at the data. Our system isn't meeting the moment just for what's happening now. So let's talk about how do we avoid avoidable disasters, and how do we be prepared to address problems that happen and mitigate them through the decisions that we make. I talk to farmers, I talk to people in forestry. I'm on this committee so that I'm talking to people all around the state and hearing from people all around the state. And I think that we need to find a way to say, where is there a vision, a shared vision on how we are going to look out for our communities using this incredibly powerful tool we have, using this tool to break down silos, using this tool to manage risk. I'm a project manager. Oh, risk assessment, risk mitigation. That's what we need to be thinking about. And so when we look at a project and we say, well, our biggest risk right now is X, does funding this project help us avoid a disaster? Does funding this aspect, and I'm even going to go to Chair Franzen's favorite thing, solar panels. Are we making the right investments? Are we mitigating the right risks in the right place for the right reasons? But having standards of where we expect risk mitigation to help. And saying we're going to balance the risk of water. We're going to balance the risk of not having affordable electricity or having insufficient energy. We're going to look at that and we're going to think about that and come up with good decisions. So that's my challenge to us as a committee, to be thinking big picture, thinking systemically like this lays out, because I think my granddaughter who's not yet born and the one who's four are depending on me, and I want to be a great, 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 great grandma, even if I'm not here to see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryder. Next up, we have Representative Scraba.
Great speech. Thank you, Chair. I've got a multiple angles here. On page five, we were talking about the patterns of weather. And the question that I always have, has that pattern occurred before? You know, it's easy to say, yeah, the pattern. How often and where has it occurred? And the current pattern, that the projected current pattern, how long would it be, are you anticipating it would be, and is it breakable? And I'll go further into the breakable thing once we get to that. Thank you.
Dr. Roop.
Yes, Chairlady, Chair Franson, thank you for that question. I won't go on a tear. I actually have studied historical climate and used ice cores to reconstruct climate to really situate and better understand, is what we're observing today different? And in what ways, if so? And the answer to that simply is yes. Yes, the Earth has gone through natural cycles of climate variability and change, mm-hmm. often really aligned very clearly with different processes like how we orbit around the sun, the tilt of the Earth and the sun. Yes, yep. And it's you nodding. We, yep. Again, we can talk at length about these.
Yes.
But what we see that's quite different from today is the rate of change. Mm-hmm. So we are seeing, and we're measuring it, right? So I think we could debate the causes of that change. But these are this is change we're observing.
Yep.
So we anticipate, and the projections show, based on physics, not presumptions about what we would like to have happen, right? It's physics, that we expect these trends to continue and within the lifespan we're talking about, right? The natural climate variabilities occur on centennial, multi-centennial cycles, and sometimes decadal cycles, which are all part of our natural climate variability. I'm very cautious to attribute things that we experience, including things like straight line winds, to climate change, because the evidence base, frankly, isn't there yet. But we can make some presumptions, some assessments based on physics, and again, what we anticipate to make some general anticipatory trends. However, temperature has a very clear signature that we expect it to continue to warm in the future, and we understand what that driver is today. And the driver today is very different from what has caused natural climate variability in the past. And we can measure that directly. So again, very happy to have a direct one-on-one conversation. As for the future trends, again, we don't go so far as to say I can tell you what year, what day, or what periods of years it will be hot, or what summer it will be cold, or there'll be a heavy rainfall event or not. Again, there's a reason we intentionally look at these multi-year time periods and talk in directions of change and averages and sort of trends. And so again, I wouldn't be telling you that on June 5th
right.
Of 2089, we can expect the average temperature to be around 98 degrees Fahrenheit. Like that, we don't, our models are not capable of doing that. Mm-hmm. And so that is not the type of prescription that we look at. Instead, we bound and look at scenarios of possible outcomes based on well-established physics in the climate system.
Representative Scraba.
Unless you, what, no.
May I add a
Dr. Hellman.
Yeah, Chair Lee, Chair Franzen, Representative Scraba, this is a great question. This is just a second what Dr. Rupa was saying, but I think it's really powerful to point out that the climate science community is very conscientious about where their certainty lies. Mm-hmm. So quite a lot of certainty about the heat trapping capacity of greenhouse gases, but a lot less certainty about things like future economic development and also the frequency of very extreme events. Mm-hmm. Extremes are very difficult to predict in these models. So we hold this duality that there are some things that we know very well, like that the climate is changing, that it has changed and it will continue to accelerate, and also things that we need to learn to live with being uncertain about or waiting to see what happens, like the future trajectory of humanity's economic development. And that's where the power of the scenario approach comes in. It's rooted in that basic physics understanding, but allows for flexibility because we do not know exactly what the future holds. I think that's a very powerful tool for you all to use as you think about what decisions you make, is to ask how robust they are in the face of those variety of future outcomes.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you. So I guide canoe trips. I've done it for 40 years. I've been through three derechos, two in a tent, one not in a tent, the straight line winds. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's normal. If a guide 80 years ago had three, two, I don't know. I just know what I've seen. I've seen weather in June, I can't remember the year, Mount Pinatubo blew. June of the next year, it rained every day in June. Every single day it rained. And I was in the woods guiding, and I was like, it's got to stop. It has to stop. And we didn't know why it was raining. And then I found out later that when Pinatubo blew, it put so much stuff in the atmosphere that it actually changed the weather. and it changed things. Mm-hmm. So when I ask the question, are there, do you anticipate or can you put it into your modeling? Because mm-hmm. we keep blaming humans, and we have some culpability here. We do. But if, for me, I have not been convinced, and I'm trying my best to look at all the sides, that it is just humans. You know, 10,000 years ago, there's a mile of ice over Ely, Minnesota. Now there's none. I see the after effects. I look at the rocks and everything got left when the glacier left and it melted. But did humans do that? You know, sort of thing. So we have to, for me, I'm trying to get the politics out of this and the science back into it. Mm-hmm. And let's have some real discussions about, does it matter that the universe changed its direction, and does it affect our weather? Does it matter that the sun has more spots than before, and does that? It's so easy to do the Al Gore thing and say it's all humans, and it's not. I will go to my grave right now knowing that it's not just us doing this. There are way more other things. So when I look at what's going on, Lee Frolick did a study, said that the trees in northern Minnesota are going to be all deciduous in 100 years, you know, and that's great. So let's not have live bait in the Boundary Waters Aquatico anymore. And I'm like, why? Oh, worms are going to ruin everything, you know. And so when I look at this policy that's coming from this affecting everyone's daily routines, I question it because, like, fire, ecological benefits, and we're all talking about, you know, we have to be careful of this and that. But when a community is faced with a fire coming to it, because the resiliency of the trees and everything has changed, and we've just like, how did that happen? We know how it happened. What are we doing about it? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm all for harvesting more of the forest before it dries up and burns. There's a group of environmentalists say, oh my, you can't do that. You're going to change the world. And it's like, it's changing already. Why not be ahead of it? So I appreciate everything you did here. I try to go back, you know, where's the initial foundation that you got your information from? The weather, is that based on, you know, a lot of different things come to mind. But I'm trying to find when your very end where you said you want to use this for designing buildings or going through build or, you know, the whole thing. Can we take the human part out of it and just look at the science part? Because I think the human part, like, for instance, we're going to need more electricity. That's pretty clear. I think it is. We're all trying to use less, but it's pretty clear. Right now, we do not have the capacity in wind and solar to pull this off. It's just not scientifically available to make it. So nuclear is like, hey, look, nuclear is simple, easy, let's do it. Let's look at it. But again, we have people saying, you can't do that. That's going to ruin the world. Why hasn't things like that been looked at in here? Thank you.
Dr. Graves.
Sure.
Yeah, Chair Franson, just to put a fine point on the climate models, I can tell you, yes, eruptions like Pinatubo, the eccentricity of the Earth, all of these things are factored into and drive the climate models that are utilized. So again, very happy to talk to you about the methodologies, but I concur and I agree with you that what we are experiencing today is both a combination of natural climate variability and change mm-hmm. and the influence of humans. It is not only... Right? And right. So scientists who tell you that, they aren't using the foundation of the evidence available to us. But we understand very clearly that what we are experiencing today and the natural climate is being overprinted by some of the impacts of human activity. So we agree on several points. And again, very happy to talk to you. But the physics of the model do account for many of the examples that you spoke to today.
Dr. Grace.
Chair Lee, Representative Scraba. As not a scientist, I think one of the challenges is that, you know, the science is important, we need good data, but I think in addition to that, we need a process for looking at it and then using it for things is where, you know, that's usually where you find the need for a thing like this framework, because we need to make decisions, so we need more energy to do a variety of things. what we're not answering that question, but the challenge that we have now is different groups are working in silos, not coordinated, and it's sort of a story here, a story there, a solution here, a solution there. And this framework creates a way to kind of test some of those solutions, do scenario planning, and looking at, does this provide the energy that we need? And then as we do that, is it cost effective so people can afford to buy the energy they need? Is it going to do the things we want to do with the energy in people's homes and community centers, et cetera? And the same goes true when, you know, in some of the built environment part of this study, you know, there's a range of things we're looking at, and designers constantly, you're dealing with a lot of different things that are going to go on in this building. So dealing with kind of change and variability is a common thing that you deal with in design. What we look for is this data showing us new conditions that we wouldn't have designed for otherwise, like this increased cooling, like this data says we maybe should be thinking about systems that can switch from heating to cooling to be able to deal with that if it happens. And that is kind of an easy thing to kind of add to the. So I think it's those kinds of things to think about and kind of the next, where do you go next with this report, which is bringing in some of the application, how could you use this, because it grounds the science and grounds the abstraction into kind of real world decision making, which I think is definitely needed.
May I add just briefly?
Dr. Rubio?
Chair Francis. And just I think for the whole committee, I think when I am working across the state in my capacity is as an extension professional, and I'm working with commodity crop producers, transportation planners, communities that have raw sewage in their homes because of failed pump stations. You know, today, you know, I've been tasked with sharing the observations and the projected climate, but that those aren't the conversations that I'm having. I'm talking about, okay, if you need to build rehab this road, are we using the right asphalt binder for the extreme heat? These are where those sort of scenarios and stress tests come to mind, because we could use what we've used in the past, or should we think about what it means to have more extreme heat summers? Is that culvert, if we're going to rebuild it, is it the right size for the volume of water it needs to accommodate to manage both upstream and downstream impacts? So just to sort of situate again in real brass tacks, like meaningful, how this matters to Minnesotans today, those are the ways that we're trying to think about how we situate this information. It isn't just these slides and data. It's really the sort of brass tacks, right? Asphalt binder, culvert sizes. Do we have clean air to breathe? And how do we make sure that we're investing in the health, well-being, and resiliency of every Minnesota community?
Representative Allen.
Thank you very much, Chair Lee. Let's get back to the report if we can. I'm looking at the bigger one that's in our packet here. Question to I guess anybody that can answer this. I see this report cost about $690,000 in 2023. Where did those dollars come from, and how many dollars were allocated total for this project?
Dr. Graves.
Chair Lee, Representative Allen. So the money for the report was appropriated by the legislature to the University of Minnesota. I'd have to go back and look at, we didn't spend all of the $690,000. We turned back 100-ish thousand, something like that. So it was all used across our different centers and working with the stakeholder groups we mentioned.
Yeah, Representative Allen, as I recall, being the chief author of the bill, I believe it was from the general fund that was included in the environment energy finance package that was passed in 2023. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Chair Lee, for that clarification. And then getting into the report itself, let's get on over to page 65. Expert insights for agriculture infrastructure, focus group number one. Looking at this one, it looks like you had three attendees representing key departments and organizations, including USDA Midwest Climate Hub, University of Minnesota Extension Regional Partnerships. I'm wondering, can you tell me the organizations that were involved that were helping with Focus Group 1 as far as who contributed to this?
So,
Dr. Grace.
Yeah, Chair Lee, Representative Allen. So the focus groups were facilitated by me and a researcher at the Institute on the Environment, and then supported by researchers out the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. We reached out to various groups in the agriculture sector to kind of get their input, and that focus group, it was as mentioned here, it was the folks at the federal USDA hub that were doing research on sort of climate change impacts to the agriculture industry, and then the RSDP folks were representing extension. So kind of USDA often works with larger scale farmers, and the RSDP folks are often working with small scale farmers. So those are the main groups in that focus group. I'd have to go back to the attendee list to see who else was in that particular group.
Representative Allen.
Were there nonprofits that were there? Were there actual farmers in attendance that were helping consult in this at all?
Dr. Graves, maybe it'll be helpful after this to set up a follow-up of the folks who participated.
We can go back and dig through that. I think there are gaps in the focus groups on certain stakeholder groups across the, because remember, we're cutting across huge sectors. So you name the sector, there's probably underrepresented perspectives of stakeholders in all those various sectors that would need follow-up to get impacts and perspectives and use cases for this data and this framework. So that, I think that's a good point. We could follow up and dig into more details with you if needed.
Representative Allen.
Because as I look through this, I mean, focus group number two, you had four attendee groups, however many that was. You guys touched on things like new practices such as growing camelina, hemp, pennycress, and diversifying crops, diversifying risk by getting into different crops and whatnot. And I can tell you that, you know, those crops are great to work with when you get an opportunity to, but you also have to have a market for it ultimately in the end. As a producer, it's our job to have a longevity plan for our farming operations in order to be able to survive. And if there are no markets for camelina, hemp, pennycress, and we don't open up the regulatory side of it in order to be able to get the manufacturers and processors into this state in order to be able to do it, we just end up exporting those businesses to other states. And that becomes a huge, huge concern. I guess my other question to you was the participants highlighted stakeholders and actors that need to work to ensure agriculture infrastructure thrives in the future weather trends. You pointed out USDA, farmers, finally, and I don't see anything as far as like the University of Minnesota's role in that, because extension and research done at the University of Minnesota, particularly around stuff like this, is critical for us to be able to make accurate decisions. And they have, of any of them, they have the only data set that we look at in terms of long-term impacts on soil and livestock here in our state. The one that has me concerned is nonprofits like Nature Conservancy. Why did you guys pick them out and list them in your groups as individuals to focus on? There's piles of nonprofits out there that do a lot of work. Why them?
Dr. Grace.
Page 67.
Yeah, Representative Allen, I think that's a good thing to follow up on. I'd have to go back and look at our notes there and why were they in attendance versus others. But again, I think it's sort of representative of that particular focus group had one set of people there that we captured their perspective. But I think there are some higher level trends that we saw in the work kind of affecting agriculture, like dealing with the changing precipitation trends of you know, lots of flooding rains that come onto fields that need to get off of those fields, followed by in the future drought. And so are there different ways to approaching fields, maybe integrating storage, things like that were the high level. But at this point, I think a lot of the, you know, the touch, when we were touching base with different groups in the focus groups, it was showing them the framework and the data and just get their reactions on, is this something you are seeing in the work that you're doing? And would a frame like this work like framework like this be useful in any way. I don't think, you know, I think it would be a whole nother study and bit of work to kind of decide what actors you need input in to kind of make decisions going forward with which the kind of framework outlines. So, but I don't know if you guys want to add to that.
Yeah.
Dr. Hellman.
Representative Lee, or Chair Lee, Representative Allen, I just to hit that point again, we were commissioned to look over a variety of different sectors to ask what could it mean to approach resilience infrastructure decision-making in recognition of a changing climate. This absolutely, there are communities, individual farmers, investors, private sector companies that would have much, much work to do to actually explore and deploy the type of framework that we're suggesting you might consider. It was not our intent to offer what the solutions are in that set, but to invite a group of stakeholders into a room who could help us illuminate whether or not this kind of sets framework could be useful in evaluating those future decisions. So any issue you all might take up from an infrastructure decision-making point of view would need to have all of the appropriate stakeholders that you think are necessary for that particular investment. And while we were seeking a broad perspective, we weren't aiming to address any particular infrastructure decision.
Representative Allen, last follow-up, and then Chair Hansen, and then Chair Franzen.
I appreciate the Chair Lee. I guess I would push back on that a little bit. I don't think you can find a much bigger stakeholder group other than the actual farmers that are actually working the ground, mm-hmm. raising the livestock, mm-hmm. and contributing to our state's GDP. And I think that is a large oversight because, you know, when we start looking at resiliency over a long period of time as producers, we're not just looking a couple years in advance. We're looking generations because that's the way we operate. I can't tell you how many times I've opened up a grain drill and seen the door where my grandfather's and great grandfather's signature is on there, saying when they planted oats, which we ended up planting oats I think it was the early 1920s in February. I mean, it's the climate is constantly changing and constantly moving. I remember just not that long ago we were planting corn the end of March, which might have been a little earlier compared to the insurance dates we were allowed to have, but that's the thing about this. And I think farmers need to be considered as part of that, the stakeholder group that you consider when you take a look at this and reevaluate it. Thank you.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just following up quickly, I think the data from the U is that over 50% of the land is operated by renters rather than the owner. And so I think looking at land ownership, particularly in agriculture, and reaching the owners, who may be a diverse set of people scattered all over the country, on their decision on what they want to do on their land versus the renter who is renting at a certain time. But that's not my question, Mr. Chair. My question, since I have the university here, is last year we appropriated money for a people infrastructure, and it was a security barriers on the Washington Avenue Bridge to prevent suicide. And I would like to know the status of implementation on that, if the university has received the money from Hennepin County to begin construction, because we appropriated that last spring, and we want to make sure, I think there's a temporary barrier up, but try to make sure that infrastructure is there to prevent suicide.
Chair Hansen, this is not the group of professionals to be asking the question, and so I'll be... We'll follow up with the university on that specific request. Do you have anything on this? Chair Franzen.
Okay, so thank you, Chair Lee and members. So, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been some bills dropped about chemtrails, also known as contrails, as well as weather modification known as cloud seeding. Mm-hmm. How does that play into your report?
That's definitely not a question for me.
Well, I'll see how we talk about the report.
Dr. Hellman.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Chair Hansen. So contrails and the variables that Dr. Root talked about are absolutely part of the system of making future projections about what the climate, that range of scenarios of what is possible. It is built, those kinds of variables are built into the model. In our specific report, do we address those individual variables? We do not. After taking a historic analysis of Minnesota climate, after offering a set of scenarios of what the future may hold in terms of how that climate is changing, we then turn to what are ways that you could think about how to make infrastructure investments in the face of that climatic variability. We certainly would be very happy to sit down and talk with you about those individual variables, but you won't find that kind of individual factor isn't something that we imagine that a committee like yourselves in infrastructure decision making is confronted, at least with respect to the legislative charges we understood it.
Chair Franzen.
Thank you. Next topic would be carbon. So carbon supposedly is the number one contributor of quote unquote climate change, correct? Well, we are all made of carbon here. And we do need carbon for flowering, for our food. So how does that play into your report? The more we lower carbon, the less likely we are going to have sustainable environment in order to grow food in the ground outside instead of living off of lab grown.
Dr. Roop or Dr. Helvin?
Yeah, Representative, or Chair Lee, Chair Hansen, that's a, so again, in this report, what you will find are historical climate observations and future climate projections. Those projections, the degree, as we talked with Representative Scraba, there are a variety of variables that influence future climate. One of them is changing concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. There are several of them, and one of the most important, at least by volume, is carbon dioxide. We are carbon-based life forms. Carbon is alive and well in this room, but CO2 in the atmosphere has a heat-trapping capacity. And as we change the concentration of that CO2 in the atmosphere, it changes the amount of heat that is held at the Earth's surface, which changes our weather patterns. After the climate projections are generated in this report, then we take that range of possible scenarios under different scenarios of what CO2 concentration and other greenhouse gases might be in the future, and again, turn to thinking about this SETS framework for how you would make infrastructure decisions to make your infrastructure resilient in the face of climate change. Do you add anything to that?
Dr. Roop?
Yes, Chair Franzen. I don't have a whole lot more to add. Those are certainly the physics. I think when we do look at, say, the impacts on the agricultural sector, there are studies that have looked at change in, say, the productive range for corn and soybean, for example, and again, very happy to share those resources with you. You are correct that in the near term, increased CO2 in the atmosphere is beneficial to certain plants. However, when we cast out further into the future, that we actually see diminishing return. And so there, you are not incorrect that we do see that and factor that in, right? We understand that plants also, photosynthesis is a thing, right? So we can see that, and that is fact. Those types of things are factored in, and there are state and region specific models that look at both those impacts, negative and positive, in regards to crop suitability and crop productivity, and also nutrients. So very happy to share some of those resources with you. Those are not studies necessarily conducted by the University of Minnesota, but by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other institutions across the nation, including in the Midwest. So again, happy to share those resources, but as Dr. Hellman mentioned, they're not explicitly factored in the report.
Okay.
Chair Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, the climate is always changing, and 10,000 years ago, there were glaciers covering the state. And if you don't know what a glacier is, it's a big block of ice, log of ice, right? Well, they're not here in the state anymore. I mean, up by Representative Scraba, there's a park that talks about the glaciers that were up Itasca County. Mm-hmm. But what doesn't change, my friends, and that's why when you talk about climate change, I don't get upset about it, I don't get worked up about it, is because my faith is not in climate change. It's not in scientists dictating what we should and should not do to save the environment, because my faith is in Jesus Christ, right? He's the same today, t-
tomorrow and forever, yesterday. And so, you know, if you've read the good book, you know how it ends. It's not with climate change. And that's my closing speech.
Thank you, Chair Franzen. Thank you, Dr. Graves, Dr. Hellman, Dr. Root for the presentation. Really appreciate, members, the robust conversation. And, you know, should we in the future want to take up some of the recommendations, I think that it is crucial, you know, to represent Alan's point for us to include, you know, a more comprehensive set of, you know, community members from across the entire state so that we have a full picture. And so just really appreciate that as we move forward. And with this, no further business before us, Chair Franzen will have the gavel on the 25th this Thursday. The meeting is adjourned.